Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Brant Courtwright, who is the author of The Neurogenesis Diet and Lifestyle, Upgrade Your Brain, Upgrade Your Life. Dr. Courtwright is a clinical psychologist and professor of psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies. He is has a consulting practice specializing in cutting-edge brain health and neuroscience-informed depth therapy. And today we're going to learn more about neurogenesis and how you can improve your brain. Welcome, Dr. Courtwright. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Would you like to tell the listening audience a little bit about your background and how you came to study neurogenesis?
Yes, well, I'm a professor of psychology at a graduate school, and I was in the process of writing a book on a holistic approach to depression, meaning body, heart, mind, spirit approaches to depression. And I was investigating the body part, the physical part, and in really looking at the literature on this, looking at the neuroscience literature, I realized that the whole basis for antidepressants is really based on a myth. And the myth is that there's a serotonin deficiency in people who are depressed. And when people take SSRIs, or antidepressants, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, they increase their serotonin levels and then they're undepressed. Well, it turns out the literature shows that actually is not true. That most people who are depressed actually have normal serotonin levels. Some studies show they even have higher than normal levels. There's a few that show lower, but most show average. It turns out that what gets people out of depression is they increase their rate of neurogenesis. So neurogenesis, as I believe you mentioned earlier, is the process of making new brain cells, the generation of new neurons. And it used to be thought that the brain stopped growing new brain cells in our early 20s. And then it was discovered that actually the brain makes new brain cells throughout our entire lifetime. And that the rate of neurogenesis, the rate at which the brain makes new brain cells, is incredibly important for cognition and memory, and for how we feel emotionally. So low rates of neurogenesis are associated with memory problems, with cognitive decline, as well as depression, anxiety, and stress. People who are depressed have low rates of neurogenesis. High rates of neurogenesis, on the other hand, are associated with the opposite, with rapid learning, with cognitive enhancement, and with robust emotional resilience and protection against stress, anxiety, and depression. So it turns out that what the antidepressants do is they actually increase the rate of neurogenesis, but they do this in a pretty inefficient way, because the antidepressants work for less than half the people who they're given to, and they come with a lot of bad side effects. For example, loss of libido, loss of sex drive happens in more than half the people. So in researching this book, I realized that actually the real story here is neurogenesis. It's something most people don't know about, that the brain is capable of operating at a much higher level than most people go around believing. And so that was the basis for the book.
So there are a lot of lifestyle effects that can either increase or decrease neurogenesis. Would you like to mention some of the things that, you know, we do have under our control, you know, exercise, diet, sleep, all of these things?
Yeah. So this, again, is a holistic approach to brain health, to really peak brain health. And so we can look at physical factors, emotional factors, mental factors, even spiritual factors, because there are at least two major types of meditation that have a profound effect on the rate of neurogenesis. So probably the most important piece in all of this has to do with diet. So if we want to build a beautiful new high-end house, we've got to use high-quality wood, right? We can't use decaying lumber or aging wood. And it's the same with building up the brain. There are a number of nutrients that dramatically increase our rate of neurogenesis. There are also certain things which dramatically decrease our rate of neurogenesis. And one thing that people should know is that just about everybody's rate of neurogenesis can be increased. It looks like about five times, maybe even more than that, with really quite profound effects on all parts of life. So this is a twofold strategy. We need to decrease those things that slow down neurogenesis, and we need to increase things which accelerate and speed up our rate of neurogenesis. So in terms of diet, there are a number, the book goes into about 30 or so different nutrients that increase our rate of neurogenesis. One of these is blueberries. Blueberries have a very powerful effect on our rate of neurogenesis. A cup of blueberries a day will actually reverse cognitive decline. It's helpful with anxiety, it's helpful with depression, and it has a very robust effect on our rate of neurogenesis. It's actually the anthocyanin dye in blueberries. So you can actually do a blueberry extract, or you can do blueberries themselves. Another is green tea. Green tea is great because it's an anti-inflammatory, it's an antioxidant, and it also has a very powerful effect on our rate of neurogenesis. Now, what we want is really about 10 to 15 cups of green tea a day. But we don't want that much caffeine, because it turns out that caffeine is actually one of those things that lowers the rate of neurogenesis. So I hesitate to say this because I know most people live on caffeine, but people should at least know what the science is, which is that any amount of caffeine will lower your rate of neurogenesis. So if you're doing caffeine, it's good to maybe try to do a little bit less. And it's best to do a green tea extract that is caffeine-free. And these are available from many different companies. Mm-hmm. A couple other things that are helpful. One is something called hesperidin. Hesperidin is a bioflavonoid from citrus fruits. And the effect of this on neurogenesis is very high, because what it does is it prevents new brain cells from dying. So when we increase the rate of neurogenesis, about 50% of those new neurons get pruned by the brain. The brain is very efficient at pruning new things unless they're used very quickly. But what hesperidin does is it keeps new brain cells alive, so we have just about a 100% survival rate of new neurons. And hesperidin, you can get it as an extract, but it's very poorly absorbed. But there's a form of hesperidin called methylcholcone, which is very well absorbed. So if people are interested in doing hesperidin, they should be sure to do the form of it called methylcholcone. And the last thing, let me just say, that's really helpful is omega-3 fatty acids, which is fish oil. Mm-hmm. So there are three types of omega-3 fatty acids: ALA, EPA and DHA. Mm-hmm. Now, about a 2/3 of the brain is fat, and about a half of that fat is DHA. DHA is the fundamental building block of the brain. So we want to give the brain a lot of omega-3 fatty acids. And by a lot, I mean most people could do between 4 and 6 grams a day. Mm-hmm. They did an experiment with monkeys where they gave a group of monkeys one diet that was low in omega-3s and another group of monkeys that was high in a diet of omega-3s. And then they looked at their brains. And the brains of the low omega-3 monkeys were very simple, undifferentiated brains. But the monkeys who had the high omega-3 diet had very complex, richly differentiated brains, almost like humans. Mm-hmm. Getting a good amount of DHA every day is probably the single most important thing anybody can do to increase their rate of neurogenesis, to decrease inflammation, because inflammation is behind most diseases and Alzheimer's, and it's also it slows down neurogenesis.
Yeah, so, Alzheimer's has an interesting history, though. Alzheimer's, many people with Alzheimer's have it because of a organophosphate chemical used to kill warble flies in non-organic beef. And so and then the other one, of course, is cyanobacter from bad fish, increasing levels of a toxic chemical in the brain. But I have something interesting to say about, you know, with autism, these children are getting high doses of heavy metals in the vaccines, and if they're unable to break them down because of a genetic detoxification defect, they get swelling of the frontal lobes. And if their fontanelles are fusing, then the swelling causes a severe problem. And you know what the rescue is for that? You know, right after they get the vaccines and they get the high fever and the encephalitis, if you give them high doses of cod liver oil, you can rescue them from autism. Uh-huh. So it's really interesting. What toxic chemicals are one of the most least understood of the brain injury. And I say this because as a plastic surgeon, I treat thousands of women with silicone and chemical toxicity, and much of it affects their brain. So, you know, when these implants rupture, most of my patients have detoxification defects, COMT, MTHFR. They cannot break down the chemicals. And so the chemicals go to the brain, and some of them are incredibly compromised in terms of their mental capacity and memory, and even get diagnosis of dementia. But yet it's all reversible. So chemical insult to the brain is way more common than we know. Of course, there's autism, which has gone totally out of control. And then, you know, all of the different chemical exposures that we have. But Alzheimer's is really, the cause of Alzheimer's is known. But the people that have, put that forward have been ruthlessly attacked. So it's very dangerous to actually say what causes Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The brain is under assault from multiple directions at this point. There are neurotoxins. There are more neurotoxins in the environment than there ever have been in the history of humanity. And it's having severe
effects.
Mold,
by the way, it creates neurotoxins that affect the brain. I have patients with moldy breast implants. Yeah. In fact, I've been on Monsters Inside Me 3 times with mold and breast implants. And some of the patients are in wheelchairs and can hardly hold their heads up.
Yeah.
At age 20. I mean, they're terribly, terribly disabled.
Yeah. Mycotoxins, heavy metals, mercury, lead, aluminum, things that they put in vaccines to preserve them. They put in these intense neurotoxins. It it's hard to really believe that they put in these powerful neurotoxins into a vaccine that gets injected directly into the body. It's unbelievable.
And they do so many of them within the first 6 weeks of life. I mean, when I don't know how old you are. I'm 63. So 68. I had some vaccines, you know, we all did. And I have a detoxification defect. So I got extremely ill when I was in the military because they made me take a bunch of vaccines at once. And that's when I started to study vaccines. And then I realized that I probably have aluminum and mercury toxicity. And I started a detox.
Yeah. Yeah. And those things have a big effect on cognition as well as emotional health as well. People feel anxious. People feel depressed. And cognitive decline sets in. But it's often an artifact of neurotoxins in the system. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And mercury, high levels of mercury make you very angry. And high levels of heavy metals are found in a lot of criminals. And they actually get better if they get detoxed. They get less violent and less emotionally unstable.
That's interesting.
It is, yeah. You should look at the prison studies. They're very, very interesting.
Wow. I had not heard of that. Interesting.
Yeah. So I think in our environment, I mean, certainly, and then when you were mentioning the blueberries, be very, very careful of non-organic blueberries.
Right.
My front desk supervisor ate strawberries the other day and ended up with her mouth inflamed and asthma, and it was all from the pesticide on the strawberry. And she had washed them off.
I don't think
normal strawberries are safe to eat right now. I mean, at least the ones she had weren't.
That's right. Strawberries are the most heavily polluted, pesticided fruit that you can get. You should only eat organic strawberries because strawberries
and blueberries too, and raspberries. Anything like an orange or an avocado or a banana, you can probably get away with non-organic. It's fine.
Yeah. The other thing with omega-3s is that when a person takes omega-3s, two things are important. One is that they should be molecularly distilled because otherwise you're bound to get a bunch of mercury. And as we've been saying, mercury is, I think it's the most potent neurotoxin known to humanity outside of plutonium. I think plutonium is more neurotoxic.
I think you're right.
So it's good to make sure that the type of fish oil you get, since mercury concentrates in fish, the bigger the fish, the higher the mercury level.
That's
so
true.
Any type of fish is going to have some mercury. So it's good to do molecularly distilled omega-3s, and it's good to get omega-3s where there's a balance between DHA and EPA. You want the EPA because EPA is a very powerful anti-inflammatory. And that's one reason it's used in strokes, in brain injuries, in concussions, and probably for the things you're also talking about, because it has a powerful effect on inflammation in the brain.
Right.
It reduces inflammation in the brain. So just to make sure that the person is buying an omega-3 fatty acid that has an equal amount or about an equal amount of EPA and DHA and is molecularly distilled, 4 to 6 grams a day, every day.
Many of my women, and my women are skewed because they're mostly chemically toxic from their breast implants. Most of them are testing stronger for evening primrose oil than they are for omega-3 straight, which I don't know why. I mean, maybe you can explain why. There must be something, though, because about the only ones that test for omega-3s are ones with heart disease.
What do you mean test? I don't understand.
Using applied kinesiology, muscle testing. They test mostly for evening primrose oil, which is a little bit different than omega-3s. But they all
have
inflammation from the chemicals. They really do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, evening primrose oil also has a powerful anti-inflammatory effect. And barrage oil, similar, right? It's what the GLA in it has a powerful anti-inflammatory effect. It takes a little bit longer to work. It takes weeks and weeks to work, but then it has a very strong effect, but on a different pathway than the omega-3s in terms of anti-inflammatory pathways.
So maybe it's the chemicals that they're exposed to that make that pathway more, you know, more advisable to use.
Yeah, may well be.
Yeah, I was thinking that omega-3s would be good. And we do have the 6-to-1 ratio where, you know, we have more DHA in the clinic. But they do test almost all the time for evening primrose as well.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting.
The other thing is that it's important to avoid what not, to look at what not to eat, to what we should avoid as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it turns out that a high sugar diet will cut your rate of neurogenesis in two.
Mm-hmm.
Also, high bad fats will do that as well. And you look at the average American diet, like the average American kid, what they have for breakfast, you know, sugar snacks and, you know, it's all bad fats and sugar.
Yeah.
You can't grow a healthy brain on that kind of a diet. You can't. The raw materials aren't there. So what we want is a diet that is low in simple sugars, sort of low in carbohydrate, high in good healthy fats, moderate in protein. So that most of the food we eat should be vegetables. The bulk of the food should be vegetables, like non-carby vegetables, asparagus and cauliflower and greens of all sorts, avocados. The bulk of our calories should be from healthy fats, avocados, grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, pastured chicken, pastured dairy. Eggs are great. The brain needs fat, both for fuel and for the basic building blocks of the brain. I imagine you are well aware of this, just how we've been sold for decades this myth that a high carbohydrate, low fat diet is good for you, only to discover that's what caused the obesity epidemic and heart disease and diabetes and most of the other things plaguing us.
Yeah, I always ate, you know, more of a high-fat, high-protein, low-carb diet, and I would only eat twice a day, which, you know, fasting. I ate at noon and maybe at 7, and, you know, the long-term fasting is a trauma surgeon, you know, I'm busy all the time. And that really was, I don't know, I guess it just, now that diet is being promoted by Dr. Mercola and a lot of other integrative doctors. And that's just what I did because I probably should have had more fruits and vegetables, but it was a interesting diet where you probably for 14 to 16 hours you don't eat.
Yes, that kind of intermittent fasting is really good for bringing ketones into the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And ketones are not only the best fuel for the brain, but they are also neurogenic. They also promote neurogenesis. So even a purely even ketogenic diet is really good for the brain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can use for fuel either glucose, sugar, which is a dirty fuel, produces a lot of bad byproducts, including inflammation and glycation end products, or we can use ketones like beta hydroxybutyrate and acetyl acetone. And the brain prefers ketones as fuel and operates more efficiently that way. It's a clean fuel. And it also promotes neurogenesis.
And it's so funny because, you know, when we were being raised, we were saying, well, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. And I just, you know, as a surgeon, I get up at 6:30 because we have to be in the OR by 7:30. I just didn't want to eat until we got out of surgery at 2 or 3. And sometimes I just ate once a day, you know. It was
perfect.
And, yeah, and that's my parents were going crazy thinking I was killing myself, but actually it probably helped my brain stay sharp.
Yeah, it was great for your brain.
Yeah. But it was only recently, though, that's come out. It really is just the last few years that intermittent fasting has been introduced.
Yes. And also, I guess it's worth talking a little bit about the microbiome, because that has a big impact on neurogenesis as well.
Right.
So one of the other horrible things about the American agricultural system is the use of pesticides, as you've mentioned, but particularly...
And Roundup.
Exactly.
And Roundup. Glyphosate. What does Roundup do to the gut?
Exactly. Glyphosate, which is the most active ingredient in Roundup, is an antibiotic.
Yeah.
And so what it does is it wipes out the microbiome.
Right.
And so it turns out that indigenous cultures have 20 to 30,000 different strains of bacteria in their intestines, which is very healthy, right? We want a lot of diversity like that. But the average American has 10,000 or as low as 1,000, which is terrible for the immune system, terrible for the brain. Most of our neurotransmitters are actually produced in the gut by our microbiome. And there are certain probiotics, certain strains of bacteria, which have been shown to increase neurogenesis and actually decrease depression and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing is that when the microbiome gets wiped out, because not only because of pesticides, but also just rampant antibiotic use and other poisons.
Yeast and mold overgrowth.
Yep, we get that too. But we also get a disruption of the tight junctions in the intestines. And the tight junctions...
Gut syndrome, yeah.
Exactly. The tight junctions keep out what's bad and let in what's good. But when the tight junctions get disrupted, they let in what's bad. And so that produces
circulating
toxins.
Immune complexes. That's what makes you exhausted about an hour after you eat.
Yeah. And when the tight junctions of the gut gets disrupted, the tight junctions of the blood-brain barrier also get disrupted.
That's why you get so tired.
Neurotoxins.
That's in your brain.
Exactly. You get neurotoxins in your brain, and then you get inflammation in your brain. And inflammation is deadly. Like, you know, when you have a bad head cold, how you just can't think very well, that's because of inflammation in the brain.
Yeah.
And so when you decrease inflammation, you get more clear.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure you know of Dr. Perlmutter's work. I've interviewed him on the radio show.
Yes,
Dr. Perlmutter discovered something just amazing recently, that he had a very high cure rate of adult onset diabetes by using fecal transplantation. So type 2 diabetes may be due to a gut flora issue, or at least treated by changing the gut flora.
Yes.
This is just fascinating, because high sugar is also, like you say, toxic to the brain.
Yeah, yeah. And the bad bacteria thrive on sugar.
Mm-hmm. And yeast do too. I mean, some people eat sugar or carbs and they just bloat up. I mean, they swell up and look like they're pregnant.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. So restoring the integrity of the tight junctions and increasing microbial diversity in the gut is also really important for brain health as well. And
glutamine is
one
good
way
to
reduce. Say that again.
Glutamine for repairing.
That is helpful. There's also a product called Restore.
I know that
which is
one. Yeah,
very
yeah.
helpful. And the other thing is to just, not only just eat probiotics, but just to go out into nature and breathe, because you get hundreds of bacteria that way. You begin to increase your microbiome. Whenever you're in nature, you're just taking in hundreds and hundreds. The problems with a probiotic is that you're only taking one strain or five strains or 20 strains.
Right.
But we want to increase it 10,000 or 20,000. And for that, we need to really just get dirty when we garden and keep the dirt on us for a little while and just inhale when we're in nature.
So one of the most important things for brain health is actually reducing stress levels. And by, I don't mean, there's good stress. I mean, there's probably some kind of stress that increases neurogenesis. I'm talking about the kind of the mental and emotional stress that dumbs you down. You know, that stress has to be addressed. And you were talking about the kinds of meditation that have been known to increase neurogenesis. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, so let's take a look at both these things, both sort of this emotional level, the level of the heart, and the level of spiritedness. So you're right, there's good stress and there's bad stress. Good stress is short-term and moderate. Bad stress is chronic or intense. So good stress we need. Good stress makes us stronger, right? Like when you exercise, when you lift weights or something, you're stressing the muscle. But then you stop and the muscle builds up stronger. And it's the same with stress. With short-term stress or with moderate stress, we are challenged by the world to bring forth new capacities, to respond in a more engaged, full way that brings out our potentials. That's how we develop as human beings. That's a good thing. We want that. We want the optimal engagement that comes from moderate stress or short-term stress. It makes us more fully who we are. And that kind of stress, as you were saying, increases neurogenesis. But that's not the kind
Especially if you have to figure things out. You know, think about the rat in a maze, okay? He has to figure out the maze in order to get the food. So that really does build brain cells.
Exactly. That's
right. And they even pass it on genetically to their offspring. That's what's really amazing. My mother, by the way, was a PhD child psychologist, operant behavioralist. So I know all about, I studied with her as she got her, I was in junior high. So I did everything, all her coursework and helped her with all her experiments. So I know all sorts of really interesting stuff about rat psychology and behaviorism. I actually met B.F. Skinner at one time. She was showing him around the university.
That's great. But this kind of stress is not the type of stress most people are faced with. Most people are faced with chronic stress that is overwhelming, or it just goes on and on and on. And that type of stress lowers neurogenesis, increases inflammation, and actually shrinks the brain.
It also decreases sleep. You know, when stress starts to cause sleep deprivation, anything that causes sleep deprivation, you're going to start to have brain problems.
That's right.
Sleep is so important.
Yeah, sleep is probably one of the most underestimated factors in health around. Getting a good night's sleep.
You don't form growth factor if you don't get REM sleep.
Yeah, and immunity goes down, neurogenesis goes down, melatonin goes down, all sorts of good things go down. You get measurable cognitive decline after one night of not enough sleep, meaning 6 hours or less.
Right, it's true. And people that don't sleep chronically, and I mean, there's some people that only require 4 to 5 hours of sleep and they're fine. We're not talking about them. But most people require 6 to 8 hours. And if they don't get it, they do start to get stupid. It's really true.
Yeah.
They don't do as well with cognitive tasks.
Yeah. And that's one symptom of stress. That's right, is not sleeping. And so for just, it's like the kind of chronic stress that most people have in their lives, it's important to find out how to manage the stress, how to regulate emotionally so that you can reset your nervous system and get a break from stress. And one way of doing that is meditation, which we'll get to in a minute. Mm-hmm. Another way is exercise, particularly right. aerobic exercise. But actually, when it comes to stress, just about any sort of exercise. Yoga is great. Lifting right. weights is great. Aerobic, in terms of neurogenesis and increasing our rate of neurogenesis, out of all the different types of exercise, only aerobic exercise increases neurogenesis. Mm-hmm. All the other types are kind of neutral. But when it comes to stress, they're all good. It doesn't make any difference. Just do something physical. It gives you a break from the stress. You need to have some kind of downtime where you can just get calm and quiet and reset your nervous system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's extremely important. And most people are, I guess they decide they can't do it because when they try to do it, they just can't get their minds to quiet down.
Yeah. So, just one more word about the aerobic exercise piece. Mm-hmm. There's a type of exercise called high-intensity interval training, which is becoming more and more popular, where people work out really hard for 30 seconds and then stop for a couple minutes and then another 30 seconds really hard and do that 8 or 9 times. Mm-hmm. And that's really good for a lot of different things, but it has no effect on neurogenesis. The only type mm-hmm. of aerobic exercise that is effective for neurogenesis is sustained aerobic exercise, meaning 20, 30, 40 minutes of running or fast walking or fast dancing or swimming or biking or walking up a stair, up a mountain, something that gets your heart rate up and you're breathing fast. Aerobic means living on air. So it means
right.
you need a lot of oxygen, a lot of breathing really hard. Doing that for a sustained period of time, 3 times a week at least, will have mm-hmm. a huge impact on your brain health. It'll also have an immediate cognitive impact as well. People's memories increase as their aerobic capacity expands. And these days, when neuroscientists want to increase neurogenesis in rats, what they simply do is they put a running wheel in their cage and just get them running.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And their new brain cell growth just takes off.
Right.
But again, half of those new brain cells die off pretty quickly unless they do something else, such as hesperidin, to keep the new brain cells alive. Mm-hmm. Now, the other major stress reduction technique that we're talking about is meditation. Mm-hmm. And it turns out there are 2 forms of meditation that have a very strong effect on neurogenesis. The mm-hmm. first kind is different forms of mindfulness practice. And the second type of meditation practice are different forms of heart opening practices. Both seem to have a powerful effect on the entire length of the hippocampus. So the hippocampus is this structure in the brain that's shaped like a crescent moon. And we actually have 2 of them, one on each side of our brain. We have 2 hippocampi, but it's usually referred to in the singular. And one end of it goes into structures relating to emotion regulation, particularly the regulation of anxiety, of stress, and of depression. The other end of it goes into the cognitive areas of the brain and are involved with the processing of new memories. So in Alzheimer's, for example, the hippocampus is massively attacked so that the person can't form new memories. Mm-hmm. So the hippocampus isn't where memories are stored, but it's where new memories are processed so that they then can be stored. So the hippocampus, it's involved in also spatial relations and the body. So it has body, heart, and mind in all of it. And it turns out that both of these meditation practices, mindfulness and heart opening practices, increase neurogenesis along the entire length of the hippocampus, along both sides, which is pretty amazing. Because many things only increase neurogenesis along one half of the hippocampus. Like antidepressants, for example, only increase neurogenesis along the emotional half of the hippocampus. Hmm. That's why you don't get a cognitive boost from taking antidepressants, because it doesn't affect cognitive portion of the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. So doing mindfulness practices, and mindfulness practices come in many different forms, but they're all designed to bring us into the here and now more and more, mm-hmm. into this present moment right now. Probably the most common form is focusing on the breath, sensations of the breath in the body, like, say, a particular mm-hmm. part of the body, like, say, the stomach area or the abdomen. You simply focus on the sensations of the breath, the inhale, the exhale, the pause. You simply close your eyes and observe and notice the sensations in your body for 10 minutes, for 20 minutes, once or twice a day. This has a powerful effect on neurogenesis. Other forms of mindfulness includes focusing on different things, such as hearing or on seeing, or in some types, it's simply bare attention, simply being aware of whatever arises in consciousness, mm-hmm. having no particular focus, but simply coming into the here and now and noticing all of our thoughts, feelings, body sensations, watching them arise and watching them pass away. And doing that, again, very powerful, the entire length of the hippocampus. The other form of meditation is different forms of heart opening. Mm-hmm. So focusing on the heart, focusing on love, on devotion, surrender to the divine, or different compassion practices. These also open up neurogenesis in the entire length of the hippocampus. And again, very powerful effect.
You know, it's interesting. You know the runner's high, the endorphins that yes. the runners get after about 5 minutes, and experienced meditators get the same endorphin relief after about 5 minutes of mindfulness. And then yeah. LDN, which we're using in all these patients who have immune deficiencies, also work by increasing endorphins and thereby increasing immunity. So endorphins need to be studied. I mean, you can feel endorphins yeah. when they kick in, you know.
Yeah.
So it's so interesting that LDN, low doses of naltrexone, also increase endorphins.
Interesting.
It is. They can cure autoimmune diseases and cancer. It's very interesting.
Uh-huh. You know, for a long time, they didn't study meditation because from the outside, it looked like nothing was happening, right? The person just
sitting. <does. laughs>
But from the inside, if you've ever meditated, you realize it's a very dynamic state. There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
And so the
Maharishi has done extensive studies, you know, the...
Yes.
They've done some really interesting. I've had some of the scientists that the Maharishi that method of meditation, which is the most studied in the world, just incredible changes in the brain. You know, different functional scans of the brain in meditators are just really. But I think it's done with endorphins. I really do.
Yeah, because the effect on stress is also profound. It's the best stress relief there is. There's all different kinds of relaxation techniques, but meditation has the most profound relaxation that there is.
Mm-hmm, it does.
Because you're contacting a source of peace inside, and the source of peace really is spirit, is our soul, our spirit. And so it then begins to irradiate out to come, this inner state then begins to come into our outer being. And so we're really...
I think it's energetic, too. I think, you know, you open your crown chakra, and that's got to have a good effect on your brain. open your third eye, that's got to have a good effect on the brain, you know.
Absolutely.
The pineal gland, that's intimately related with enlightenment. So, much of the spiritual enlightenment occurs with changes in the brain.
Yeah. I mean, science is just getting around to this. Science is actually way behind the spiritual traditions in this. It's just beginning to confirm what the spiritual traditions have been saying for thousands of years, which is that we can live at a higher level if we open to it with practice, right? It takes some kind of spiritual practice to do this. But then consciousness changes consciousness. And consciousness actually then begins to change the brain because it all happens through the brain. All changes in consciousness affect the brain.
And look at the breatharians. I mean, they've been shown to be able to live without food and even without water for long periods of time. They take energy directly into the system through these higher spiritual techniques and use the energy directly.
Yeah.
So, that's what we're capable of. I mean, right. I've not done it myself, but I know people who have, and so it is possible.
Yeah.
And that's the energy system you're tapping into.
Right.
So it's pretty powerful.
Are just beginning to come upon us. I think that all of these movies and TV programs about superheroes are really just kind of future memory. Like, it's like we are beginning to see what is possible, and it's beginning to show up in the collective consciousness in these kind of forms. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the other thing we should probably also address here is the level of mind, because neurogenesis is stimulated best when we involve all dimensions, body, heart, mind, spirit. So the physical dimension, the emotional dimension, the mental dimension, as well as the spiritual dimension. So we haven't touched on the mental dimension, and we probably should before we end here.
Sure.
So it turns out that the brain needs stimulation. The brain craves stimulation, and it needs optimal stimulation. It's sort of like stress. Too much or too little is bad for it. Right. Too little stress and the brain shrivels up. Too much stress and the brain shrivels up. Just the right amount, Goldilocks amount, and the brain thrives. It's the same with mental stimulation. Too little and the brain stops growing. Right. Too much stimulation it becomes stressful. We need a kind of optimal engagement. So it turns out that there is measurable cognitive decline at two periods in a person's life, very often. One is when they graduate from college, and the other is when they retire.
Yeah.
Unless when they graduate from college, they then go into a job that requires them using their brain, like teaching or a professional or a business person or something where you have to use your brain, then there is no cognitive decline. But if you get into a job where you don't use your brain, there's a gradual decrease in cognitive capacity at that point.
Same you can have hobbies. You know, you can have hobbies where you use your brain too.
Exactly. So if you use your brain in a way that stimulates it, then you're going to be in good shape. And it's the same with retirement. When people retire, if they do something, it's like the idea is lifelong learning, really. We need to be continually learning new things.
Right,
and so it's good to be reading. It's good to be taking classes. It's good to be taking seminars online. It's good to be writing. It's good, even if you're only just writing email. It's good to be using your brain this way. When you use your brain, you also build up something called cognitive reserve. And cognitive reserve means that if you do get Alzheimer's, you actually won't experience symptoms for a very long time. It turns out that teachers have the lowest rate of Alzheimer's of any profession. because it's a profession that they use their brains and they've built up cognitive reserve, as has anybody who uses their mind in their work or in their hobbies, as you're saying. So one thing that people often think of, well, I'll just do crossword puzzles. Well, it turns out that the literature is not very promising with that. Mm-hmm. Doing crossword puzzles is helpful for doing more crossword puzzles. But that's about it. It doesn't really generalize to other brain functions. And so we need to exercise the brain in lots of different ways. So we need to be using the left brain in terms of reading, writing. We need to be using the right brain in terms of listening to music, in terms of watching things, observing things. We need to be doing different things, taking a different way home from your usual routine stimulates the brain. When you're in new environments, like travel is one of the best things you can do for your brain. When you are in a new environment, this is hugely stimulating of neurogenesis, and it also keeps those new brain cells alive.
Right.
It's like Hesperidin in that sense.
Yeah, that's just very important. And folate is very important, too. Folate was the one thing that differentiated the nun study from those who got Alzheimer's and those who didn't. So evidently, I think folate's important in the detoxification pathway. And mercury is damaging. If you have high levels of mercury, you're more likely to get Alzheimer's.
Like
you said, it's one of the worst toxins that the brain can have in terms of inflammation. So it makes things worse.
Yes, that's right.
So get rid of your mercury. Don't eat too much tuna fish. They even have a warning on tuna fish now that pregnant women shouldn't eat it. That's really scary, isn't it?
Yeah, I think anybody who eats tuna fish at this point, it's probably not a great idea. Because any
not
amount
every
of
day anyway.
You're taking in, it's not good.
Be very careful.
What?
Yeah. Be very careful eating it every day. That's the problem.
Oh, my God,
Eating it frequently.
Because it's like there's no such thing as a safe level of mercury. I mean, any mercury is going to be neurotoxic. You may not feel it for a while, but it's going to have
it's also the most common cause of high blood pressure. You know, that essential hypertension where they say they don't know the cause. If you detox the mercury, their blood pressure usually comes way down.
Interesting.
It affects the kidneys. So if you've just developed high blood pressure and you're a little irritable, you probably have high mercury.
You know, there are so many neurotoxins in the environment at this point, many of which aren't even identified, but many of which are identified. Another one is smog. Smog, it turns out, the small particles in smog, the particles that are like 2.5 millimeters, micrometers, excuse me, and below, those are so small that they are taken in by the lungs into the bloodstream and actually cross the blood-brain barrier where they just
wreak free radicals
in the brain. They produce that's right. They produce free radicals, they produce inflammation, and they also just destroy brain cells.
Yeah.
And it's
some of those studies were done at Emory here in town.
It turns out that some people are estimating that 20%, maybe 30 or 40% of Alzheimer's even is related to smog. In Mexico City, they have now found amyloid plaque in 11-month-old babies.
Right? Oh, my goodness.
Amyloid plaque is the plaque that is one of the culprits in Alzheimer's.
Yeah, it is.
Having this appear in 11-month-old babies is like unheard of. But the levels
really
of smog Mexico City are horrible.
The two places on the planet where it's the worst is Mexico City and then Beijing, China. My brother is a high-altitude physical chemist. He's the president of Aerodyne Corporation, and he's developed machines that measure the smog.
Excuse me.
He's educated me on that, and it's very, very true.
Yeah.
Well, we are coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Well, you can visit my website, which is brantcourtright.com, BrantCourtright.com. And my book, The Neurogenesis, Diet and Lifestyle, is available on Amazon, or you can order it through any bookstore.
Great. Well, we've certainly learned a lot about brain health in the last hour. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, next week we will be interviewing Dean Schleiter on Fearless. That's Fearless, L-E-S-S. And then Carolyn Jarvis, Life Before Life, How Soul Agreements Direct Our Destiny. Thank you very much for joining us. We've been interviewing Dr. Brant Courtright, The Neurogenesis, Diet and Lifestyle.